This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Andy Herber, a physician assistant in hospital medicine and prior clinical laboratory scientist at Mayo Clinic's Rochester campus. Hyponatremia and hypernatremia are common findings in both the inpatient and outpatient arenas. Sodium disorders are associated with an increased morbidity and mortality for patients. Reviewing sodium abnormalities is typically not a favorite among clinicians, myself included, but understanding their evaluation and management is imperative to achieving optimal patient outcomes. This episode is the first episode in our lab medicine edition and is focused on how primary care providers can treat patients with sodium abnormalities. Today, we're joined by Dr. Mira Kettis, a Mayo Clinic nephrologist, associate professor of medicine, and highly decorated expert educator. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Kettis.
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure.
All right. To get things started, Dr. Kettis, let's talk sodium. As far as key principles when we're tackling sodium abnormalities, are there a few that you'd want the audience to be aware of?
Thank you for bringing that topic. And I'm really excited to hopefully try to present it in a way that makes folks excited about it, not fearful of it. And I think if there are main principles to consider, I would think of three main ones to keep in mind. If you have hyponatremia, you have a water problem. It's not a primary sodium problem. I think that's the first part that folks can get stuck on. You know, you're not talking about the amount of sodium you're bringing into your body that's affecting your serum sodium concentration. It's actually water. So number one, it's a water problem. You're either drinking too much or the kidney can't pee all of it. Number two, be careful. There may be more than one problem causing the hypernatremia or the sodium disorder at the same time. So, and sometimes it's hard to tell that at the beginning. Sometimes you may discover that after you start the treatment process. So just be aware that that can happen and be on the look for it. And the third principle is it's so important. Yep, and that may be the most challenging part of even my job managing this is to figure out what the patient's volume status is. What do I mean by that? Are they too wet, too dry, or just right? Because that can guide your differential diagnosis hunt, and it can also guide your treatment plan. So these are the three main principles.
Awesome. Thanks for walking through that with us. So when we talk about hyponatremia, I feel like we should start there. It's the most common electrolyte disorder that we see in the hospital, very common outpatient. What's like on the top of the differential then for hyponatremia?
Yeah, thank you, Andy, for bringing that up. I think the number one thing to do is to verify. Is this real? Do I really need to get excited and go down the whole process of getting the right tests and looking for the right thing? So verify it. And the most important way to verify hyponatremia is to actually check his serum osmolality. So that should be a knee-jerk reflex. The minute you see hyponatremia, add on a serum osmolality. That guides you to pursue, do I need to pursue that workup and management of hyponatremia, or this is completely something else? It could be, we've learned about translocational hyponatremia in the past. Is it too much sugar, too much protein? And I admit, I don't see that very commonly. I see it in the hospital, but not as common. But just know that if the serum osmolality is the same direction as your serum sodium, then keep going. Then you're on track here with the hypernatremia issue. So that's number one. The second thing is really to find out, is it that the person is drinking too much water, or is it the kidney not peeing enough? And really the most important test to look for that is urine osmolality. So serum osmolality is number one to figure out that it is truly a hypernatremia problem. Number two, is it a kidney problem or not? And that's where the serum osmolality comes into play. And the basic way to approach it is this. If my urine osmolality is less than 100, this person is drinking too much. And the reason they have hyponatremia is because they're over-drinking. And that may be apparent sometimes in certain medical conditions, especially patients underlying psychiatric illnesses, or perhaps on medications that makes them very thirsty. Or it may not be apparent. Maybe something that you discover by treating them. You know, you withhold the water and all of a sudden they're correcting so fast. You're like, oh boy, that really was truly a primary polydipsia or drinking too much. So you can use your evaluation to guide what your differential diagnosis is. Now, if it's more than 100, if your urine osmolality is more than 100, that's really where the fun begins, because you know that the kidney's not doing its job appropriately and that there is this hormone, ADH, that's acting on the kidney, allowing it to hold on to water, but that's not appropriate. It's doing this in a diseased state, not a physiologic state, causing you to have hyponatremia. So number one, serum osmolality, confirm. Number two, urine osmolality. The 100 cutoff is your guiding principle here. And then the third thing is volume, okay? Is the patient wet, dry, or are they just right? So if you can think of this in this organized fashion, your differential is going to follow. So we talked about drinking too much if your urine osmolality is less than 100. We talked about there's something wrong with the kidney. There's an ADH present that really shouldn't be there. And that's when your urine osmolality is more than 100. And now you've got a differential, right? Why is my ADH present? Is it supposed to be there or not? And your volume status will guide that.
What about urine sodium? I feel like that sometimes is recommended by nephrology. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you, Andy, for bringing that up. Urine sodium can help you and can hurt you. So you have to check it in the right context. If you're trying to differentiate someone who may have SIADH, what is SIADH? You have too much ADH that is not congruent with the volume status, meaning that this person is euvolemic, they're not volume up, they don't have underlying disease process that can cause ADH to be up, like heart failure or liver failure, for example, but they have too much ADH. Where is the ADH coming from? Well, it could be nausea. Nausea triggers ADH. It could be lung disease. It could be pain. Postoperative pain is a really strong trigger for ADH. So it's important to recognize that if you're trying to differentiate someone who has hyponatremia from SIADH versus hyponatremia that's perhaps from hypovolemic state, someone who's truly volume deplete, urine sodium is really helpful. Why is that? If I have somebody who's volume deplete, and just to kind of anchor that in the concept so I don't lose you all with acronyms here. If you're volume deplete, you ran a marathon, you're exhausted, your volume, maybe you have a GI illness with lots of diarrhea, for example, and all you could replace is just water. You didn't replace the salts that you've lost. You have a state of low volume, but more water than salt in your system. Your body's normal physiologic response is to hold on to salt and water to keep you alive. And when you're so volume deplete, you will hold on to water even if it is not appropriate, meaning that you're holding on to water to the point of getting you to be hyponatremic, which is not a normal physiology, but it's doing that to keep you alive. So when you have that perfect context, the urine sodium should be low, right? Because your kidney's holding on to salt and water to try to save your life. Those are the patients that benefit from IV fluids, and those are the patients that a urine sodium will be low. Now, let's talk about contrast that to a patient who on an antipsychotic medication, for example, or anti-seizure medication who developed hyponatremia because of the syndrome of inappropriate ADH. They look euvolemic. Sometimes it's hard to tell if they're euvolemic or hypo. So you're kind of wondering, right? So you can have that same person who had the GI illness, but then you add that element of medication effect that makes you wonder if ADH, SIADH is present. And you're not so sure about their volume status. It's not a clear-cut story. Then a urine sodium can really help you, because if this is a euvolemic SIADH, then your urine sodium should be high, should not be low. You should not be holding on to sodium. So urine sodium is helpful when you're on that fence of volume status, normal versus low. If I may digress and just give a pearl here, urine sodium can hurt you if you're trying to figure out if somebody who has heart failure and liver failure is also volume deplete or not. What do I mean by that? If you've got heart failure, liver failure, your body thinks you're dry. That's the mechanism of heart failure, right? You have what we call low effective circulating volume. You're not perfusing your organs appropriately. Both liver failure and heart failure will do that to you. The downstream effect of that is that you have a heightened response to hold on to salt and water. Not appropriate, their volume up, but that's what's happening in response to their diseased cardiovascular state. So if you have that patient and then you check your urine sodium, what do you think it's going to be? It's going to be a low urine sodium. Why? Because they have a diseased state. They have a diseased heart, either from heart failure or liver failure. And then you could think to yourself, oh boy, urine sodium is low, then they must be dry. I better give them fluids. And then all of a sudden you're chasing the wrong lab and losing the context of what their volume status is, what their history is, that would have guided you to treat this person very differently in the setting of hyponatremia. So this is a really long-winded answer to your question. Do you check urine sodium? Yes, if you're questioning SIADH versus volume depletion. No, if you have a patient who's volume overloaded.
I got to believe there's a wide variety of hyponatremia, and there's got to be different kind of how you stratify it. I'm guessing you don't want to be called as a nephrologist every time you get sodium of 133. Is there kind of a triage that you, how you break down managing hyponatremia, and when do you want to be involved, or when do they need to go to the hospital?
Absolutely. And I think that's probably one of the key takeaways from today's podcast, is one to worry and one to pursue more workup. So if the sodium is between 130 to 135, you have time. You're not sitting on a ticking time clock. You can relax, sit back, verify, have them come back for follow-up, see what their volume status is. This is not an inpatient process. Review their medication list, get a feel of what their hydration diary looks like. So that's your 130 to 135 or 130 to normal, essentially. If it's less than 130, I think you just need to pause and see how low, right? So if you're in that 125 to 130 range, I think you just have to pay a little bit more attention to go ahead and pursue your workup right away. Don't sit on it for too long. It still can be outpatient. Doesn't have to be something you rush into, unless you have a patient who has a lot of comorbidities or has subtle neurological symptoms that are new. So most patients are not going to be symptomatic, presumably unless it happened acutely, with a sodium less than one, with a sodium above 128. So I would say, generally speaking, between 125 to 130, get your serum osm, get your urine osm, see them in the clinic, see what's going on, make sure there's no ongoing neurological symptoms, and then you can work up in an outpatient setting. I think once you drop less than 125, in my mind, all bets are off. You really have to take this more seriously in terms of triaging for admission. You know, if you're already in the hospital, giving your helpful nephrologist a call and say, hey, this is new and I don't know what's going on, or can you walk me through the right workup here? So 130 to 135, outpatient, no problem. 125 to 130, I would pause and think about the patient's comorbidities and if there's any subtle neurological symptoms to guide how aggressive you go in terms of admission, for example, or consultation if they're already in the hospital, but pursue the right workup. And if it's less than 125, I think it's fair game to give a handy nephrologist a call, make sure they're on the safe side. And as you know, Andy, a lot of patients come into the hospital at the 110 or less than 100. I'm not going any lower. I'm just giving you a range, but obviously that's a nephrology consult until proven otherwise.
Outpatient, sodium comes back low. Is there something they can do in the interim before they're waiting to recheck? I know sometimes you tell the patients, hey, take it easy on fluids, or sometimes you say, hey, here's some salt tabs or a bag of pretzels that you need to eat. In the interim, when you're waiting for that repeat draw, what are kind of your guidelines as to how to manage that?
Great question. I think the answer is not as straightforward, unfortunately. It's easy to tell somebody drink less water or tell them eat more salt, but it really has to be catered to the clinical context of that patient. I mean, if it's a heart failure patient, I'm not going to recommend salt. I will recommend salt restriction because in my mind, I already diagnosed them. They probably have hyponatremia from their heart failure. or if I have somebody who has Crohn's or inflammatory bowel disease, I know they're predisposed to loose stools and diarrhea. That would be a person I say, bring in more salt in your diet, right? You're probably tend to run on the dry side, and the hyponatremia is probably more of the hypovolemic state. Or if you have a patient and you know that you as a primary provider added a bunch of medications that could be associated with ADH. So in your mind, you're like, oh, I wonder if that's a side effect from the drug I started. Let's start with fluid restriction and see how that goes. So I think it depends on the clinical context, from dry, wet, or somewhere in between, and it's usually drug related.
Okay. So last question on hyponatremia. Say you have a patient who doesn't kind of line up with the book. So they show up, they're euvolemic, you draw their labs, and shockingly, they come back with a sodium of 127, which I'm guessing primary care providers are seeing a lot of this. What would you want the primary care provider to do with a euvolemic patient, not on meds, or just a random isolated sodium of 127 to better classify?
Yeah, great question. So number one, really have a good feel of what their volume status looks like. Number two, I really think you can use your diagnostic testing to help with your classification. So looking at the urine osmolality, making sure you have a serum osmolality that confirms it. And that would be a classic person to check your urine sodium, right? To see if what you're dealing with here. So I think do your diagnostic testing, making sure that there aren't any supplements or things that maybe are not as transparent as far as the medication list. And then when all else fails, and we see that not uncommonly, I think it's very reasonable to send them to a nephrologist for second opinion. Chronic hyponatremia, no clear diagnosis. And we have patients who have your SIADH unknown. You have no reason to explain it or attribute it to a cause. And this is where you can have to have the discussion about, well, I'm sorry you have that. We've dug in, we've ruled out everything, but we got to treat you as such because you can't live at 127. What I mean by can't live is it's not safe for you to have chronic hyponatremia at a level typically less than 133. You have higher risk for osteoporosis, falls, and all sorts of adverse long-term side effects. And so those are the patients where I'd say we need to talk about what our treatment options are for SIADH. And that's when you think about things like urea supplements or salt supplements and fluid restriction, sometimes a combination of those.
Thank you. So that kind of wraps up hyponatremia. What about the patients that show up, you check their electrolytes on their physical, or they come in, you know, with other symptoms that warrant a BNP, and lo and behold, they have hypernatremia. What causes that?
Yeah, thank you, Andy. So I can tell you from experience, it's very rare to have hypernatremia in the outpatient setting. It's way more common to get hyponatremia. And having trained in Rochester and coming to Arizona, I think folks are way more predisposed to hyponatremia out here in the desert. You've got the extremes, people who don't drink enough and people who just drink a lot. Anyways, so the two things that should come to mind to you is somebody who fasted from water and their labs were way late in the day and they really just deprived themselves from water for a really long time. Or the other thing to think about is, could their thirst mechanism be impaired? Is this somebody that there could be a predisposition for a cognitive problem, maybe even an element of delirium? Are they on medications that could affect their mental status? And I say this because even if you have diabetes insipidus, right? So that's the feared form of hypernatremia. If you have an intact thirst mechanism, you won't get hypernatremia. It'll be high normal, but you won't get full-blown hypernatremia, meaning you have a serum sodium above 145. So thirst mechanism and how long have they abstained from water for?
Is it helpful to get urine studies on hypernatremia, or is that kind of just a hyponatremia evaluation?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's helpful in guiding whether you're dealing with an issue that's a diabetes insipidus where you need to hunt down for central or nephrogenic, or it is not a kidney problem. This is probably GI. And you'll see that more in the inpatient setting than the outpatient setting. Outpatient setting, I would focus on thirst as really being your biggest culprit that can lead to that. Urine osmolality is obviously you want to confirm with serum os. Always do that with hyper or hypo. But urine osmolality is really critical to differentiate, is this person hypernatremic and peeing a very dilute urine? What do I mean by that? If you're hypernatremic, that means you don't have enough water. A normal renal response is hold on to every drop of water. That's a normal kidney. But if your urine is dilute, you're actually peeing a lot of water inappropriately. That should not be there. So the urine osmolality is a good guiding principle. In general, if you've got a urine osmolality less than 300, then you need to think about a diabetes insipidus process. If it's greater than 300, then you're asking yourself, boy, so if my kidney is doing such a good job concentrating my urine, why am I still hypernatremic? And that's when you start thinking about GI. So what do I mean by that? Believe it or not, we see that not uncommonly in people who have high protein in G-tube feeds or high protein TPNs. If you're giving this individual a high amount of protein, that translates into a lot of osmolality in the urine. And you can't just pee sediment. We have to pee liquid, right? And so for all the additional osmolality you're giving a patient, you have to pee that osmolality. So there's this concept of obligatory water excretion. You have to pee it out in something. And so you're losing some of that free water to mixed in with the additional osmolality that was introduced to the patient through nutrition, for example. But it's not because it's a primary kidney issue. I know I kind of went a little bit into too many details, but yes, urine osmolality is very helpful to differentiate renal or diabetes insipidus versus non-diabetes insipidus.
So as a primary care provider is kind of working up sodium abnormalities, there's got to be like a handful of medications that you see commonly that are causing sodium values to either go up or down. Is there a few that come to mind to you?
Antidepressants, anti-seizure, antipsychotics, and maybe even NSAIDs. It can happen. Just thinking of common things being used.
Okay. It's my understanding that the individual that's been on a antidepressant for 20 years is probably not going to be the one that gets hypernatremia secondary to an SSRI, right? These are typically your patients that you just started on an antidepressant, maybe like weeks later they get hyponatremia. Is that true?
I think it's fair to say, Andy, and I also want to emphasize that oftentimes there's another change. There's another risk that put them into hypernatremia. So you could have had somebody who was on this drug for a while, but then you add a new drug, or there's a lifestyle change or a dietary change, or maybe another disease process that evolved that predisposed to ADH access. So having that underlying chronic use of an SSRI, for example, did it play into the big picture? Possibly, but it's not the only reason they ended up being hyponatremic.
Okay. We get a lot of hyponatremia, obviously, from diuretics. Is thiazides worse than loop? Is loop worse than thiazides? Kind of what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, diuretics. We live and die by diuretics. So thiazides, if you were to remember like basics of diuretics and sodium disorders, if you were to pick a diuretic that's most likely to cause hyponatremia, think thiazides, any type, chlorothalidone, indapamide, hydrochlorothiazide. And that problem becomes a lot more accentuated and as you get older. And there are actually studies to show that. And so thiazides, hypernatremia, what about all the others? So in general, all diuretics can cause hyponatremia. The one that is least likely to cause hyponatremia are loops. And that's why we use loop diuretics quite often in those patients who have hyponatremia and hypervolemia at the same time. They can save a life because the way loop diuretics work on the kidney, they are able to interfere with the kidney's ability to hold on to water. And so if you were to ask the opposite question, which of the diuretics can cause hypernatremia? You can actually get that with loop diuretic, but you'll never get it with any of the other diuretics, especially if you're using a loop diuretic coupled with no oral intake, either because the patient is altered or you have them MPO for a reason. These are the folks at high risk of getting hypernatremia from a loop diuretic. So thiazide in one extreme, loop diuretic on the other extreme.
I've seen steroids can cause hypernatremia sometimes, or a Cushing type of response. Are there any other medications that can cause hypernatremia that you can think of?
I think the ones to think about would be lithium, obviously, comes to mind. And the reason lithium does that is it directly attacks the part of the kidney that helps you hold on to water. Another caveat with lithium is, and we see that, it's long-term use. People have been on it for several weeks to months to years. Not someone who just got started on it a week ago. And so lithium to me is the one that goes highest on my differential for a cause of diabetes insipidus and hypernatremia.
Okay. And we talked about this a few times throughout today, but people really like that, like threshold, that cutoff. So when, as a nephrologist, what sodium values scare you? Where's your cutoff as the patient, you know, no longer should be managed as an outpatient?
For hypernatremia, I'm going to be honest with you, Andy. I'm pretty confident that you're not going to see an outpatient hypernatremia that will be over 150. Like I said, these are going to be your inpatient cases. 150 to me means this person is in major water deficit, and they probably aren't going to be able to do it on their own at home if they were able to get to 150 in the outpatient setting. That's somebody I'd be very concerned about. Again, their thirst mechanism and their ability to keep themselves out of that danger. And another caveat, and I even mentioned how sodium disorders contribute to morbidity and mortality, is slow correction of hypernatremia is associated with high mortality. And so some hypernatremia, I don't dilly-dally. I treat, and we have a little bit more wider range for correction than for hypo.
Okay. And then what number at hyponatremia?
I think less than 125, as we mentioned. That's definitely something I would take very seriously and consider admission or hospitalization.
One of the biggest fears that providers have when they see hyponatremia is that rate of correction. And if we're talking about like the outpatient setting, people are probably nervous. I mean, I know we're nervous in the hospital, but people are nervous to go too fast. Is there reassurance you can provide or recommendations you can provide about rate of correction for outpatient providers?
I'll be completely honest. I would be very fearful in managing severe hyponatremia in the outpatient setting. If we're dealing with the 125 to 130 range that I mentioned that could potentially be in the outpatient setting, I would say with an 8 mL equivalent correction is completely reasonable, because you're already kind of above that threshold of fear. You know, you worry about the rapid corrections when you've got a sodium of 116 and you're trying to go up. And typically these patients have a lot of other comorbidities that can put them at risk for rapid correction. Liver failure patients, hypokalemia, those who are also on thiazides. These are all things that can put you to rapid correction. But from an outpatient standpoint, I think 8 mL equivalents is a reasonable range or a goal to achieve. And you'll achieve it and you'll get the patient corrected above 130 pretty quickly, because you're starting at 125. Again, less than 125, I really would strongly recommend at least an emergency room eval.
I know you mentioned this earlier when you talked about starting patients with potential SIDH on salt tabs or urea. Is there one patient that benefits from salt versus urea? Or how do you differentiate, you know, which one gets which?
Yeah, great question. So a couple of things to think about. If my patient has underlying hypertension, I try not to use salt tablets because I don't want to drive the hypertension worse, and I would gravitate to urea. If the patient tends to run low blood pressure, I start with salt tablets first instead of urea. And then if blood pressure is not an issue, then it honestly comes down to taste, cost, and preference. And I wish I had a good way to tell you why one would work better than the other, but in my experience, some people respond better to salt over urea or vice versa.
And they should continue on that indefinitely, or just until underlying cause is treated, or until their sodium is above a certain number?
Yeah, I think it's all of the above, Andy. I have some patients, as we kind of, you mentioned this earlier, they're euvolemic, they're not on any drugs, and they're still hyponatremic. And you're like, I'm sorry, I've dug every hole and I can't put you in a category of why you have hyponatremia. you're one of those people that have chronic hyponatremia and it's not safe for you to have chronic hyponatremia. So you are stuck on long-term chronic treatment, which it's unfortunate when you tell people you have to restrict fluid for the rest of your life and you have to be on salt tablets or urea. So that's one category of folks. But everybody else kind of falls into what you said, which is correct the underlying problem if it is correctable. And you keep it until you get to the safe zone. So once I get my sodium more than 135, I start to slowly back off on the treatment, usually start backing off on fluid restriction because people are just starving for more water, and then repeat and then slowly wean them off of whatever that treatment regimen was.
Can you comment on like the implications of hyperglycemia or hypertriglyceridemia on hyponatremia?
Sure. And that goes back to how it's important to verify. And so checking that serum osmolality is going to be critical. I always find it fun when the serum osmolality is normal and the serum sodium is low. And then that's my easy consult. I was like, oh, I'm not going to manage that. I'm not worried because I'm treating the serum osmolality. That's what's changing cell volume and movement of water inside the body. That's what I'm worried about. And so if the serum osmolality is normal or high, then that's when you start thinking, okay, it's not a ADH issue. This is too much sugar, too much paraprotein, too much cholesterol, and that you got to treat that underlying problem. And I think another caveat to think about, those pseudo hyponatremias, you're not going to get a pseudo hyponatremia of 110, 116. They're going to be usually those subtly low. That becomes an annoyance. You know, why is the sodium 127 or 128? Help me out. But it's very rare. I've never seen a low, is significantly low sodium, less than 125, that's translocational or pseudohyponatremia.
All right. As we wrap today's discussion up, which has been fantastic, by the way, thank you. What are some things, maybe a top three or things that you wished PCPs knew maybe before calling you or if they were managing hyponatremia? What are some pearls that you'd want to leave people with today?
I think number one, develop your own barometer of fear and anxiety about your sodium. So if the sodium is 125 or lower, you should get help, whatever that help might be. And if it's hovering in that 130 to 135, then you have some space to think and figure it out. So know at what level you need to send someone to the emergency room. So 125 for hyponatremia, I say 150 for sure for hyper. When we're dealing with hyponatremia, always think about getting a serum osmolality and a urine osmolality. In fact, both of those tests will be helpful for hypo or hyper. So think of those are your key go-to laboratory assessments that you want to pursue. And then number three, just be aware of general clinical context that can be associated with either. So someone who has a cognitive problem or a thirst problem that deprives them from access to water, that's the person you want to worry about or think about hyponatremia for. And then the bucket of hyponatremia, think of three main categories. It's either a drugs or unknown or an underlying cardiovascular disease process, mainly heart failure or liver failure. And then the third bucket is someone who has a predisposition to being dry. So remember your three buckets, remember your barometer for concern or escalating care and your basic testing approach.
Fantastic. Well, we've been talking all things sodium with Mayo Clinic nephrologist, Dr. Mira Kettis. Thank you for your time, Dr. Kettis. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcast, please follow us as we tackle other laboratory abnormalities and electrolyte abnormalities in the near future. Thank you all for your attention today. And remember, as Teddy Roosevelt said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Take care, everyone.